This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Lighter tea and let it be. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by, and big thanks to, our sponsors, Archaeological Research and Supply, Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, The Heart of Humboldt, Sisu Extracts, and Sensa Valley. Thank you very much. We could not do it without you. There is an age-old struggle that's kind of like a tug-of-war that never really ends. It happens in every region, in every state. The combatants on one side pulling in one direction include the market, money, and profits. On the other side pulling in the opposite direction, the environment, regulators, and regulations. So, do we allow individuals and businesses to save money and maximize profits by either overlooking environmental concerns, just occasionally enforcing environmental regulations, or do we strictly enforce environmental protections, which can add costs to businesses? The cannabis industry is not immune to this. True, lots of cultivators always have been and still are good stewards of the environment. Also true, some are not. Things like water diversion, water pollution, trash in rivers and streams, land grading, solid waste dumped on land and in rivers, hazardous materials leaching into water, pesticides making their way into rivers, wildlife and fisheries damage. With California's legalization of cannabis, we have, though, a chance to get this right, do the cleanup, enforce the regulations, and move forward. So in the next hour, we're going to talk with those who want to make sure that the legal cannabis business takes all of this into account. Joining us here in the studio will be cultivator Drew Barber from East Mill Creek Farms in the Petrolia area. We are also going to be hearing from Peggy Olofsson and Trillian Schroeder of Emerald Hills Environmental, as well as Scott Greeson of Friends of the Eel. First, here in the studio is local cultivator Drew Barber. As I said, he's with East Mill Creek Farms near Petrolia. Thanks for being here, first of all.
Yeah, thank you.
You are a permitted cultivator, is that correct? Do I have that?
That is correct.
How long? Since the beginning of permits?
Well, yeah, so I got my county permit in October of 2017 mm-hmm. after working on it for 2 years. Mm-hmm. And then I got my state permit January 2nd.
Soon after, right. Ready to go.
Yeah, I was the eighth permit. In the state of California.
Really?
Yeah, they're only temporary permits at this point, but nevertheless, I was proud of that, number eight.
You should be.
I wanted to be number one, but, you know.
Well, hey, eight in a state this size is pretty good.
Yeah.
Pat on the back for that. Here's a simple question to get us started here, then. Why go that direction? It's expensive. There are a lot of regulations. It's a lot of hard work to get it done. Why go to the expense and the trouble?
To the expense and the trouble of permitting?
There's
a lot of reasons. I think there's a lot of good reasons. I think a lot of us saw what I've been calling the 215 frenzy mm-hmm. Ramping up over the years, and things just kind of got to such a frenzied state where there was this quasi-legal business that was taking place all over our county, all over the North State, and people were just coming in to extract, and it was happening at a level that just, it was okay at first, you know, and it just kind of built and built and built until I think a lot of us felt like, whoa, this is a little too much. And that was one reason, I think, to be interested in going into compliance. But there's many reasons, I think. Of course, most of us voted for legal recreational mm-hmm. cannabis as well as legal medical cannabis many years ago. And those reasons, you know, extend all the way to urban areas where people have been incarcerated for possession or selling these cannabis products. And, you know, those are huge costs, social costs to the urban environments.
That's a huge issue on its own.
It is. It is. It absolutely is. And it has a huge impact on the choices I think a lot of us made when we wanted to legalize cannabis, is that we wanted to stop that from happening. It doesn't seem like a criminal activity.
Yeah, it's an issue of it's a moral issue, almost justice and so on.
Absolutely. So in a certain way, that was a little bit of a shadow hanging over, at least for people who were aware of it, that was a bit of a shadow hanging over the cannabis business before the state got involved, which was, you know, after we voted to legalize recreational cannabis. So it becomes a whole different thing now. So now there's a business. I think it draws on a lot of skills, intellectual skills, farming skills, across the board. We have people who, I think there used to be a perspective that as a parent, if your kids didn't go away to do something somewhere else, gain some experience, whether that was college or other jobs or something like this, you know, of course, not everybody felt this way, but some people felt this way, that if your kids just stuck around on the farm and grew black market cannabis, that was like, it was just... For some people, that was not a comfortable thing. And for some people, it was fine and it worked out. But I think now with legalization, it draws on a whole different level of skill sets. And there's really...
You have to be a business person now.
There's no limit.
You're subject
limit.
To some of the same considerations and concerns that people in any other business would be.
And I would actually go even further to say way more, just because we went from being the least regulated
to
industry to the absolute most. So
but
difficult.
With that regulation, though, doesn't that give us an opportunity to at least get this right?
Absolutely.
From an environmental standpoint, which is what we're talking about tonight.
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways, this opportunity that you speak of, I really do see that. And I see it on many different levels. In the environmental context, I think we're looking at... when we look at big agriculture, like really big agriculture,
right.
When we talk about homogenizing crops, we talk about reducing the number of farmers, we talk about growing the size of machinery that's being used. These are all things that are detrimental to our social and environmental context, our habitat.
And some of that big ag is not necessarily as responsive to some of the environmental concerns as this industry is, and not even as highly regulated.
Well, right. I would say none of it's as highly regulated. That's a bold statement, but I think we can say
and we're going to hear later in the show about that too.
Yeah. So I guess just the concept that by keeping farms as small as possible, we can have a more ecologically stable or sustainable or harmonious practice than if we break down those small farms and homogenize them or come in and conglomerate them.
And one quick question here before we bring in some other voices, and we're going to get to this a little bit later on, but is it your sense that a lot of the other cultivators you know are thinking along the same lines? I know that there are some who don't, but are most people on board with what you're...
Yeah, I think a lot of folks are on board with it. I think there's more to it, though, too, because like you were saying earlier at the opening of the show, that there has been some major environmental degradation as a result of cannabis cultivation. And we could even say that some of that has been a result of, you know, relatively small farms. Of course, the concept of small is different now than
right.
it used to be.
It's relative, yeah.
Yeah. So now we're pretty sure at this point, from the state's perspective, the state is very clear about this: 10,000 square feet and less is small. 10,000 square feet or 10,001 square feet and more gets into medium, and then eventually gets into large. So, I think. To get to that point, I think there have been small farms that have done damage to the environment. So it's a little more complex in the sense than just saying, oh, we got to keep small farms, and small farms will be environmentally mindful. So
not necessarily, unless they're complying with the best practices that that are suggested by a lot of different groups.
Yeah, yeah, and I think the state is taking it a good shot at trying to trying to encourage that, and you know, hopefully it'll be effective. Of course, a lot of us would like to be on the page where we are responsible for our own practices.
Sure,
a lot of us who live on our farms, for example, we drink our water that comes from underneath our farm. Our spring is below our farm. So we treat everything that we put into that soil as though it's going into our drinking water, you know, eventually, of course, you know,
it might be.
It will, exactly. So we try to be mindful of this. And I think a lot of other folks are on that page, but I think when agriculture is taking place away from where somebody lives, some of those impacts start happening in a way that those folks aren't aware of.
They may not be using the word mindful the way you just did.
I
think that's a big thing. Let's bring in Peggy Olofsson right now. She is with Emerald Hills Environmental, which is a planning and consulting firm helping out with permitting and regulation compliance. Recently, producer Larry Trask asked her why so many operations ended up in environmentally sensitive locations to start with.
It was the people coming away from the city and wanting to live in rural environments, and they found cannabis as a way to be able to support making that transition and to be able to have a good lifestyle. That was fun and virtually carefree. They wanted to go remote anyway, and then it became as the grows were becoming larger and new people were coming in. They tried to hide the grows in areas that were really, really inappropriate, particularly steep areas. They tried to make it so that they would be harder to get to for raids. They tried to do a lot of things which just made them even higher risk, higher environmental risk is what I'm saying. So which came first, I'm not really sure. They wanted to go remote anyway, and then it just became more remote and more sensitive areas as they started wanting to make more money on the properties. They started doing things that were not environmentally conscious in order to be able to do that.
That gets to a lot of what you were just saying. Some are mindful of that and some are not. You agree or disagree with what you're hearing Peggy say there?
Yeah, I think she's spot on in a lot of ways. I mean, of course, generalizations are difficult, but I think that there is a vein of extreme moral integrity that runs through our communities and the cannabis culture, the traditional cannabis culture. Mm-hmm. So it's difficult for me because I know a lot of people who are in that vein, and those are the people who, in a lot of ways, grew this county in so many.
There are a lot of the people who came up here at first. Some of the pioneers who came up here in this business had the environment on their mind at the same time.
Absolutely, yeah. Exactly. So this that vein is a strong vein of people who don't need to be told how to behave in either moral or environmental protective manner. They just do it.
Yeah.
That's the best case scenario.
Sure.
And the cannabis industry has had a lot of that for years, but of course not nearly 100%, or not nearly as much as we'd like to see. Yeah. So we need the regulations.
Here's another issue as it relates to environmental stewardship in this area, and it gets to what you're just talking about there. Current regulations being followed by permitted cultivators, such as yourself and others, versus lack of regulation at unpermitted sites. This is Trillian Schroeder at Emerald Hills Environmental.
I think, you know, if every cultivator out there was complying to these rules and coming in, that to generalize, they would be pretty sufficient. But they're in reality, they're only as sufficient as how many people aren't complying, right? So to impose these regulations and say, oh, they're not working, really doesn't work if 80% of the cultivators out there aren't actually complying. And, you know, this gets into this whole thing about how illegal grows are going to start impacting legal grows and some of the tensions that could arise there, right? So, you know, with these whole in-stream flow requirements, it's, you know, can I not pull water today because the 20 illegal grows up the creek from me are pulling out all the water, right? So there's going to be some interesting tensions that are arising and are starting to arise there. And I think really the only way to evaluate the impacts is, you know, once everybody is in compliance. And I think, you know, lumping cannabis cultivation as a whole and looking at its environmental impact could be a mistake. I think maybe what might be a better approach is looking at the legal grows and the illegal grows and trying to sort of differentiate the two impacts, because I don't think it's fair to look at it as a whole if there's really two very, very different growing practices going on.
All right, Drew, following on that, two questions, one and a follow-up. First of all, do the current regulations go far enough? Are they sufficient if everybody abided by them? And do they go far enough?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, again, it's a yes and no answer.
Yeah.
So on one hand, the current regulations are doing exactly what we talked about not doing at the beginning of the show. We talked about keeping mm-hmm. farms small. Current regulations push farms into growing larger.
Why?
Because it's very expensive. There's an economy of scale.
Yep.
The way the regulations are coming out, a small scale farmer, well, any farmer needs a separate license to put their product in a vehicle and travel to
yes.
a distributor.
Mm-hmm.
This is a pretty big problem for people who live in really rural and remote places and have small batches.
Mm-hmm.
You get on the phone and you call a distributor and say, "Hi, I'm, you know, Joe, the small farmer. I've got a batch of 25 pounds." They're going to say, "Yeah, well, I'll wait until I can pick up, you know, 500 pounds in
exactly.
your area, because they're coming up from Los Angeles
yeah,
or something
right.
like this." So, in that sense, yeah, no, the regulations are not going far enough. In fact, they're actually doing the opposite of what we want them to do, but in a different way. Because I know
this is something that in a new business could be worked out over time. Is that right?
Well,
I mean, you would hope. Anyway.
Well, so this is our opportunity, and
exactly.
what we've seen in California and the nation as a whole, as well as, you know, just modern agriculture in general, we see a trend towards fewer diverse farms. You know, larger single owner, corporate owner farms mm-hmm. using heavier equipment. And we see that environmental degradation taking place. We also see what happens to cultures when the people there's no work anymore. People have to leave because it's one farmer now doing the mm-hmm. entire area. So that is, to me, that is a very big problem. And there's a solution for it that's also in the regulations, which I find really exciting, which is that small farms do have this little bit of gold in the regulations, which is the agricultural co-op, the cannabis cooperative association. And that's where the small farm can work together with other small farmers.
They can deal with scale then.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
we can
right.
access a license together that we couldn't
sure.
otherwise afford. So now maybe we can go in together to purchase mm-hmm. a transport license instead of having to do it on our own.
Is that happening?
It's slow, but it is happening. Yeah, there's a few co-ops starting. I'm part of one that's starting in the Mattole Valley,
mm-hmm.
And I'm also working with the Cal Growers Association to promote co-ops to form throughout the state. And we've built a couple of different slideshows and presentations
yeah.
that we've taken around to help encourage people to form co-ops
yeah.
instead of just going out of business.
Well, Larry and I have gotten information since we've been doing this show about that very thing, people trying to get that going in various parts of the state. So let's hope that happens. And it also gets me to another question, though. Do you perceive that there is tension building in the cannabis industry between those who have decided to become permitted and those who are resisting that and deciding not to?
I don't really notice that myself a whole lot. I'm sure it exists.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't really speak to it. I'm in the headset or headspace where I'm encouraging people to become legal so that we can have them as part of our cooperative. And I'm encouraging people to, you know, in our area.
Are people receptive to that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, what it really gets down to, I mean, everybody has this question. Everybody wants to be legal if there's a market.
Exactly.
If there's no market, and there's all, like, just as one example, in Humboldt County and many counties throughout the state, in order to cultivate cannabis, you have to pay up front as a cultivator. Mm-hmm. So here in Humboldt, for outdoor, it's $1 a square foot. So I'm on the hook for basically $10,000 of additional, we could consider it property tax, whether I choose to grow or not, whether I have a crop failure or not. That's what I have to pay every year for having that permit. So when you're out money as a farmer before the crop is even in the ground, this becomes a little bit upside down.
Welcome to the business of agriculture, huh?
Well, no. Well, yes, yeah. Yes, in some ways, but this is different. Mm-hmm. Most agricultural businesses, I don't know if we could name a single one where they have, all of them have to pay to put the crop
in. Some
are
subsidized, though.
Absolutely, yeah. Certainly the cannabis industry is not subsidized at all, but certainly to have to pay before you have the potential of bringing that back in is difficult from an agricultural perspective because it is unstable. Mm-hmm. So
there could be an even bigger opportunity here. Is it the case that pot cultivation alone is to blame for environmental damage in this region, or is it just one part of a much larger puzzle, one that paints a picture of damage brought about by overall unplanned development? Let's go back to Trillian Schroeder and Peggy Olofsson.
The majority of pollution that we're seeing is due to development, and yes, like that would happen if it's an apartment building or cannabis cultivation. Certainly, a lot of the farms that I go and see, their irrigation practices, their pesticide use practices, they are pretty minimal. You know, we're not seeing a ton of irrigation runoff into streams. I think people get that that's a bad thing. And I'll also say, you know, when you compare it to other industries like forestry, I see a lot of really negative impacts. There's logging that's happening on the parcel behind me, and those guys, they came in, they cut an access road by just ripping up a ton of trees. And, you know, just driving heavy equipment back and forth across this area. And I'm absolutely not familiar with a lot of the regulations that they have to face. We focus mostly on cannabis regulations here. But I will say, like, just looking at that causes a ton of runoff and erosion. And looking at that compared to what's happening with cannabis cultivators and, you know, the significant restrictions that they're facing, you know, there's definitely a discrepancy there. Absolutely.
Any kind of development that's not following best environmental practices in terms of the kinds of and the way that you build your roads and the way that you maintain your roads and the way that you withdraw water, the way that you use your pesticides, if you're doing that, any kind of an agricultural operation, they are all going to have similar impacts if they're not following best practices. And it's not just the cannabis industry. But I grew up in Garberville, and I recall when the first growers, with back in that day, it was a very mellow thing in 1972 and 1973, and then around about 1975, people discovered the sensimea, and they discovered that they could start growing it for production, and it started becoming a big thing. They started developing their lands for commercial production, black market, and the impacts that I saw just among the community that I was among was huge. And it was thoughtless development is what it was. It was pushing dirt across rivers in order to be able to have access to another place on the other side of the river without thinking about it. That doesn't have to be a cannabis operation. It can be anything. And it's Trill mentioned the logging industry. They traditionally had done things that way all the time. There's the logging tracks all throughout the hills that are just very, very badly designed and then abandoned without any thought to what the long-term impacts are going to be. And that's what we don't ever want cannabis to ever be like. I don't think that cannabis has been that bad on average. There's some huge grows that are really bad, but I don't think the industry as a whole has had nearly the devastating impact that logging and the transition of logging practices over time is what that has had. But there have been very significant effects. There are places where rivers go dry because of, not rivers, I would say streams go dry because of withdrawal of water upstream. It wasn't tracked to see how much of it was for cannabis and how much of it was for the other land uses that the person, that the people, the many, many people in the watershed had. But a lot of it can be thought to be cannabis usage, and there is a lot of water that's used. It's not insignificant, specifically related to cannabis. But I guess my point is any kind of thoughtless development is going to have an equal impact.
So Drew, I want to pick up on a thing that she just said there, thoughtless development, and put that together with what you said before, mindful. And is it the fact that if we looked at this from a smart planning development standpoint, maybe we could get this right? Agree?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I tend to think that that can be a little clunky. Maybe what's better is to educate the market to demand a product that is mindfully cultivated. Mm-hmm. And if the market requests that, then that's what the cultivators are going to provide. To try to impose that on the cultivators from the outside and not give any incentive in terms of...
Couldn't cultivators use that as a marketing tool?
Absolutely, though? Absolutely.
And would that be a way to educate the consumer to request that or require that?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, it kind of comes up, is that the cultivator's job? Sure, in some way.
Chicken and egg.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, I mean, we have a market out there. So as new as the cannabis regulations are, there's also a new the market is new at understanding, mm-hmm. and having any understanding, any connection to the farm. It was always just this mystery because nobody would stand behind it because it was illegal. So you just got what you got and you enjoyed your high or whatever. So now you can follow that chain all the way back to the source.
And you should.
And you can look at the imagery that might be provided by that farm or by other people, or you know, the testing results that the state is requiring, I think, is a really good thing, a really good step, if we can keep that efficient in terms of
cost. It's
kind
of the same sense of why some people like to go to farmers markets, and they know that farmer, and they know where that tomato came from.
Or the peach,
or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Same kind of thing.
Yeah, it's really difficult with cannabis because of the regulations. There has to be
Maybe we'll get there in between. Let's hope.
Yeah. Right.
We're going to continue our discussion in just a minute. First, a reminder that we'll be taking your calls a little later at 707-786-5946. You can email questions and comments, as always, to us at studio@humboldtchronicles.com. As we go into a break here, a cultivator minute from Lauren Quackenbush. She's with Dirty Business Soil Consulting and Analysis. By the way, the cultivator minute is made possible by, big thanks to, Sensa Valley and Heart of Humboldt.
So when we think about environmental best practices in agriculture, I think that there are three main goals, and those are going to be to reduce water loss, to reduce nutrient loss, and to reduce the incidence of pests and disease. And there are a number of different ways to go about this. The practices can pretty much be broken down into three categories, being cultural, biological, and chemical. Some of the simplest things to do are really straightforward, like mulching and cover cropping, which both help to reduce evaporation of water off of your soil. The benefits of cover cropping are multifaceted. Not only do they bring nutrients into your soil, so it reduces the amount of amendments that you need to add, but it also protects your soil from soil erosion. Particles and sediment in rivers and streams is the number one source of water pollution in Humboldt County. So however we can reduce erosion is going to help our waterways. Biological approaches that are best management practices are going to be things that protect your plants from pests and diseases and therefore reduce your use of pesticides and fungicides. Those are going to be things like inoculating with mycorrhizae, trichoderma, and bacillus, as well as using compost teas both as extractions and foliar sprays, and then using beneficial microbes as a first step to dealing with pests and diseases. I'm Lauren Quackenbush, and I'm a pest control advisor and soil scientist at Dirty Business Soil. If you'd like to contact us, you can give us a call at 707-633-8885. We also have a workshop coming up on August 2nd in Garberville at Humboldt Brand Business Solutions. That's going to be our IPM report workshop, where you can create your IPM report for state licensing and farm planning.
Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles. To set up the next part of our discussion, we want to go to Scott Greeson. He's the conservation director at Friends of the Eel. First, Scott reminds us that the current cannabis industry is, in some ways, a reflection of prohibition.
We have to look, frankly, at the context we're in now, the way that the cannabis industry has developed. And I think any fair student of that history understands that the cannabis industry came to be concentrated in places where it was hard to find and hard to enforce the laws against cannabis production. If cannabis were just a commercial crop, it's very likely that the existing incentives around commodity crop production would have had it produced in Kansas and Colorado and, you know, the Central Valley. That's where the economics point to, you know. But because of cannabis prohibition, places like Humboldt County especially became hotbeds because it was a place where we could grow with relative success as against the people who are trying to get rid of it.
And if you're just joining us here in the studio is Drew Barber of East Mill Creek Farms near Petrolia. Drew, he's kind of getting at what you were mentioning earlier in the show, and that is that a lot of the folks who came up here early on did have the environment on their mind. So we have that group that's already here and that has done a lot of the groundwork. But we also need to make sure that those going forward adopt those kinds of concerns and awareness of the environment, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think they're sort of two separate. At this point, they have to kind of become two separate things, sort of the illegal growing and the mm-hmm. legitimate growing, the legal growing. We can't really – what happens a lot is that the compliance process is influenced with a bias that's based on a judgment of the illegal growing, which isn't necessarily a good approach. So just as an example, if you blew it up in the illegal era, mm-hmm. you'd have enough money to successfully move through the current regulatory yeah. bottleneck mm-hmm. and vertically integrate. So we're essentially, the regulations are sort of rewarding what we could consider, you know, not the best operators from the last era. So that's sort of one of the effect of the regulations. But I feel like, there were early folks who of course, some of which had environmental consciousness, some of which who didn't, mm-hmm. Many of whom were giving back to the communities. But what happened in this process is that we ended up with, because like you said, it didn't go to Kansas where it would be more economically viable, we ended up with this agricultural commodity or agricultural product that is still in the small farmer's hands. And that's this huge treasure. And I think that's our opportunity that we keep referring to with the regulations.
Do you think we're going to get this right? Do you think that permitted growing, that is a cultivation that is environmentally aware and concerned, do you think that we're going to get this right?
That's a tough one to answer.
I know. You don't have a crystal ball.
Yeah, I don't have a crystal ball.
What's your sense as of right now? I know that, you know, we're only a half a year into this process.
We blew it. We totally blew it. The state, the way this works, I don't know if people know, of course, cultivators are aware of this, but the state had a cottage, a small, a medium, and a large license. Mm-hmm. The environmental impact report said large licenses shouldn't happen. That's too big.
And the state a lot of discussion about that.
Yeah, yeah. The state said, great. So the state threw it out. But then at the last minute in the emergency regulations, the state also said, oh, and by the way, you can have as many small licenses as you want and stack them up.
Right.
So huge failure in that. I mean, like, what's the point of mm-hmm. having an environmental impact report that says you shouldn't have the larges, but now have as many larges as you want, just composed of many, many smalls?
Yeah.
It's absolutely asinine. So in that sense, we've already totally blown it. But there's a lot of folks hanging on, and there's still, the opera is not done yet.
Yeah. That's a good way to put it. Let's go back to Scott Greeson now at Friends of the Eel and hear what he has to say on this about whether we're going to get it right.
The short answer is absolutely. The little bit longer answer is, well, it depends. And yes and no, and we'll see. But I guess the first thing I want to say is that I think that legalization is something we absolutely have to do as a matter of justice. It is a moral imperative because, and I think, you know, people whose memories run long and historians will tell us that the war on drugs has always been a war on some kinds of people. And, you know, the effort by the Nixon administration at the time to paint the broader white counterculture, the hippie pushback against the establishment in the late 60s and the early 70s as druggies was an overtly political effort to delegitimize that part of the resistance to the establishment. But much more consequentially, it became a war on black and brown people. And I think it is absolutely imperative that those of us who've enjoyed the fruits of cannabis criminalization support legalization on moral grounds, because it is not okay for us to live on the profits that are generated by a system that puts black and brown kids in prison at a rate far beyond, you know, the white people who are growing the weed. That's not right. And we can't have an economic system that's based on that kind of artificial demand. So we've got to start with that, I think. But there's also, you know, a real environmental injustice here. We have externalized the costs of this industry. And when the Back to the Landers discovered that they could grow weed and make a living at it, there were few enough of them. The landscape was empty enough that poor practices didn't really make a big difference. They were doing better than the timber companies had done before. So it seemed like, hey, on the whole, we're doing better. But that's not the situation we're in now. And we have imposed a really significant cost now on salmon recovery. It looked like we were going to be able to bring fish back in Redwood Creek 15 years ago. And that progress has been lost. We're now losing them. And this is despite millions of dollars of investment and lots of time in restoration projects. We're moving backwards on that. So, you know, I think there's a way in which we owe a kind of restorative justice to the ecosystems here. Having said all that, the best answer about legalization is that what's really going to finally get us to, I think, a place of honesty with respect to our impacts and the economics of this industry, which are, you know, still largely determined by a black market, is national legalization. That's the only way we're really going to get to a coherent understanding of this industry and its impacts and a fair allocation of burdens from it.
Drew, do you have comments on that?
Yeah, well, I agree with a lot of what he's saying there.
He said a lot of the same things you've been saying.
Yeah, certainly about the injustice. What it brings up for me, though, is kind of the question of what is getting this right? So if getting this right means that there are no more small cultivators in Humboldt County because they've all had to move to large scale, or not the individuals necessarily, but the operations mm-hmm. have had to move to consolidate in different areas outside of the county, or just, you know, the rare precious ag land we have, and then all of a sudden it puts Humboldt County, which has limited ag land, in direct competition with counties that have way right. more ag power than we have. If that's getting it right, you know, and if our perception of that is that, okay, that's going to drive people out of the hills, and okay, that's going to improve the conditions of the streams, then that's one getting it right. That's not getting it right to me.
Right.
I'm not sure that having our community of Humboldt County crumble is going to be an environmental benefit. People will seek their income. The remaining people who are left here are going to seek their income mm-hmm. in whatever way they can.
So what is getting it right?
Well, I mean, I think it's different for everybody. But for me, getting it right is to have communities continue to have an economic viable business out of cannabis mm-hmm. that is a craft culture. For me, getting it right is that Humboldt County recognizes that we are a small county with limited ag land, and we really push craft cannabis. Mm-hmm. And we already have the name. We just need to continue to encourage it and to not allow massive farms to come in and to sort of greenwash that name out.
And to keep the standard high.
Keep that yeah. standard high. Keep it personal. Right. Keep it environmentally harmonious. Is, for me, that would be getting it right. And that's where I go, yeah, I think the co-op is a really great way to do it. So that the small farmers can keep having that larger market share.
Yeah. You're preaching to the choir here. Drew is going to be staying with us. And next we will take a look specifically at whether and how much disincentive there is to permitting, and the cultural change brought about by legalization that may be hard for some to accept. As always, you can reach us by phone at 707-786-5946 or studio at HumboldtChronicles.com. Back in a moment. Welcome back. You're You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Here in the studio with us is cultivator Drew Barber from East Mill Creek Farms near Petrolia. And Drew, in this last short segment that we have here, I want to ask you a couple of quick questions. One, some of the regulations we've been talking about and the costs must be a disincentive to some people. What do you hear about that?
I think it's market driven in a lot of ways. I mean, I think there's been a lot of excitement. Oh, get your permit, get signed up. There's going to be this mm-hmm. broad open market. And when that wasn't the case, from January 1st until July 1st or mid June, when the market started opening back up, that was certainly a disincentive, you know, for people watching, people who were further back in the process, watching people like me go, I don't know why I can't justify all of this from a business perspective. Mm-hmm. I can't encourage someone to do it because there was no market at the time. So yeah, if there's a market, then sure, there's incentive. If there's no market, then there's no incentive.
Well, and just to follow on that, what about the acceptance of that kind of change in the cultivation community, which is, as we know, a community that was not regulated until January of 2018. Now it is. Now there are permits to get, best practices to follow, regulations to adhere to. What's that doing to the community?
Are people
accepting that change well? I'm sure it varies from person to person.
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak for everyone. I guess what I can say is that at least in our little community, our little social experiment, if you will, there's people who have come out there to help make that community happen. There's
right.
the whole community, and this is true for Humboldt as a whole, it's driven by the people who see a need and just charge it and make it happen.
An intentional community in some ways, this whole area.
We are, yeah, in so many ways, and that's one of the great things about our communities up here and our community as a whole. So I think there's folks who want to stick around, and those are the folks who want to really participate and make things happen. I saw lots of people come in over the last many years who did a lot of extractive work. Mm-hmm. They never joined the fire department. They never right. sat on any of the nonprofit boards. You know, I mean, I don't need to point fingers, but you know, generally we see this, and it's okay with me as far as like when I put my only community hat, my pro community hat on, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with those folks going to the next venue that they need
right.
to do their work at. Because for me, I just really want to raise my kids in a healthy and happy community.
Sure.
And I want to see it continue to grow and be a great place to live.
Following on that, back now to Peggy Olofsson and Trillian Schroeder at Emerald Hills Environmental.
It's very hard for even people who want to be conscientious about the environment and their effect on the environment. It's very hard to all of a sudden be told that this water is not your water. It belongs to the state. It belongs to the federal government. It belongs to the people around you, and you can't do what you want to with that water. And it's hard to basically just to think that you can be told specifically what you have to do with your water. It's a mindset that landowners in general don't really have. They're not really comfortable with that, being told what to do on their land. And then the growers, they historical cultivation folks, the marijuana growers in Humboldt County and other rural areas, it's just not anything that they've ever considered before. And as far as they can see, their understanding of what's okay for the environment is based on what they see on their little property. They don't have the understanding of what happens when you multiply that by 10,000 other neighbors and them all doing what they think is right on their property. So it's the cumulative impacts of things that's really much harder to get people to be sensitive to and aware of.
One of the things I hear a lot is that the culture that has been part of what people love about growing cannabis up here is rapidly diminishing. And that's inevitable as people move from sort of this outlaw culture lifestyle into a more permitted, you know, it's you're not, you know, growing cannabis in the hills anymore. You're running a business. And yeah, absolutely. That's definitely changing the culture for sure.
And Drew, following on that with what you were just saying, there are those who will do whatever it takes to stay here. And whatever it means, they'll do the work to stay here, right?
Yeah, sure. The folks who are attached to the outlaw culture so much so that they don't find that they love this place anymore. you know, that's
but
one.
But people
one
like
mindset.
You will do the work to get permitted to do whatever it takes. And I know you're part of the fire department out there and everything else.
Yeah, you know, I guess I kind of outlaw culture is one piece of it, but really, what it is it's an alternative culture. Mm-hmm. It's sort of alternative to what's going on in the rest of the state of California and more urban places. So the movement in cannabis right now being for me being to work together as small farms to help small farms be successful, that's an alternative movement. You know, that's not a strictly capitalistic perspective. So I think there's a lot of people in cannabis right now being drawn to this co-op movement because of that, because there's cannabis always drew those sort of alternative mindset individuals, some of whom that alternative only meant outlaw, but for others it meant, hey, this is just a different way to do it, you know. So
I think that's a key. You've mentioned that a couple of times, and you know, Larry and I always look for nuggets in each of these shows to take away. Your idea of the co-op movement, I think, may turn out to be a key, don't you think? For folks like you and other, if you want to call them small farmers or individual business people, to be successful.
I'm really big on the co-op concept right now because, I agree with what you just said. I think when we start to expand it throughout the state and we start to educate consumers that, hey, when you purchase co-op product, that's the only way to guarantee that you're buying product from a small farm. Because the way the legislation's written, you can't have any stacked licenses to become a member of a co-op. Somebody who has 100 5,000 square foot licenses could sell their product and claim it to be from a small farm and be accurate. It's from a small licensed farm, even though there's 500 or 100 of those other licenses stacked next to it.
Well, thank you for being here. It's been illuminating. You've had a lot of good things to say. We appreciate you making the effort to be here.
Well, thanks you. It's a pleasure.
We want to thank our guest, Drew Barber, here in the studio. Also, Scott Greeson from Friends of the Eel, Peggy Olofsson, and Trillian Schroeder from Emerald Hills Environmental. Larry, did you learn anything?
Yeah, I learned that an hour is not nearly enough time to cover this topic.
Isn't that the truth?
But it was interesting as I was doing the interviews and listening to Drew just now, how much the artifact of prohibition remains a factor in cannabis production now, even though, you know, it's now legal, and I realize it hasn't been legal for that long, but it was quasi legal for quite some time, but the prohibition is still an artifact in there, and it's affecting how things exist today.
Yeah, good point. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted soon at 941lounge.com, at lostcoastoutpost.com, and at iTunes for listening and downloading. I want to thank again our sponsors, Archaeological Research and Supply, Eco Groovy Deals in Arcata, Sisu Extracts, the Heart of Humboldt, and Sensa Valley. Thank you very much. We will be back with the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on the third Wednesday of each month. So we will see you next time, August the 15th at 6 o'clock.